Welcome to Torah Dimecha Nachyomi with the OU Women's Initiative. My name is Lynn Kraft, and today we will be learning Melachim Bet, Perek Chet, Chapter 8. In the last Perek, Perek Zion, Chapter 7, we learned about the end of the Siege of Shomron, a miraculous salvation delivered by Hashem through four lepers, right? The ones who were the first to notice that the Arameans had abandoned their camp. This Perek, Perek Chet, Chapter 8, can be divided into three distinct sections. So the first section is Psukim Aleph through Vav, verses 1 through 6, which is about the Isha HaShunamit's return. Psukim Zayin through Tevav, verses 7 through 15, starts talking about Elisha's anointment of Hazael as the king of Aram. And finally, Psukim Tet Zayin through Chav Tet, verses 16 through 29, talk about the next two kings of Malchut Yehuda. In Pasuk Aleph, verse 1, we're told that before the siege and the resulting famine had even begun, Elisha had apparently warned the Isha HaShunamit to leave the country for the 7 years during which Malchut Yisrael would suffer from the famine. And this is really our first indication that Elisha had even known about the famine in advance, obviously through prophecy. The Malbim actually asks, if this was the case, why didn't Elisha miraculously stop the famine from happening, right? He's provided food for so many starving people until now. Why didn't he provide food for the people this time? And the Malbim answer is actually based on the famous Gemara in Tani, Daf Bet Amud Aleph, that we already quoted back in our study of Perek Daled, Chapter 4, in the context of Elisha's reviving the Isha HaShunamit's son. And the Gemara says, Amar Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan said, Shlosha maftechot biyado shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu, shelo nimsiru biyad shaliach. There are three keys in the hand of Hashem that were never given to a human messenger. Ve'ilu hein, mafteach shel gishamim, mafteach shel chaya, u'mafteach shel tchiyat hametim. And these are the keys, the key of rain, the key of life, and the key of revival of life. And the Malbim actually quotes a different chazal, that humans who do succeed in taking these keys from Hashem may hold on to them only one at a time. And he explains that just as chazal say that Eliyahu had to return the key of rain in order to take the key of reviving the dead so that he could revive the widow's son, which is why Hashem sent him back to end the famine immediately afterwards, the Malbim suggests that so too here, since Elisha had already taken the key of Tzchiyat HaMetim, of revival of life, from Hashem when reviving the son of the Isha HaShunamit, he wasn't able to take the key for parnassah, for livelihood, from Hashem now in order to prevent the famine from occurring. Interestingly, this is the second time we see Elisha displaying his gratitude to the Isha HaShunamit for her financial support of his prophetic career, the first when he gifted her a child, and now by helping her avert the forthcoming crisis. Perhaps because the Isha HaShunamit fed Elisha throughout the past many years of his visits to Shunam, he was now helping her feed her family during these years of famine. In Pasuk Bet, we see the Isha HaShunamit listened to Elisha's advice and moved her family to the land of the Plishtim for the duration of the 7 years. And the Malbim actually notes that unlike Elimelech in Megillat Rut, who lived during the time period of the Shoftim, and also abandoned his people during the famine of his era, because he decided on his own to leave them during the greatest time of need. In contrast to that, the Isha HaShunamit, who is also wealthy and a leader of her community, she only left her people at the behest of Elisha, who was the Navi at the time. And so he explains that this is why Elimelech was punished for leaving, because his leaving was considered abandonment, whereas the Isha HaShunamit was not punished because she was leaving at the behest of the Navi and was not considered to be abandoning her people because she was doing it because she was told. In Pasuk Gimel, in verse 3, we're told that at the end of the 7 years, the Isha HaShunamit returned from the land of the Plishtim and went to cry to the king about her house and fields, implying that they must have been taken by others in her absence. And in Psukim Dal through Hey, verses 4 through 5, the king is actually described as having been in the middle of a conversation with Gehazi, with the king having asked Gehazi to tell him about all the great things that Elisha had done, and that Gehazi responded to the king, describing the miracle of the revival of the Isha HaShunamit's son when the Isha HaShunamit herself approached. And so Gehazi exclaimed, Aduni HaMelech, Zot HaIsha V'Zevena Sherechaya Elisha, my master, the king, this is the very woman, right? And this is her son whom Elisha revived. It's pretty unbelievable that this miracle was still being discussed so many years later by none other than Gehazi. It seems like he still has not learned his lesson, and he was still seeking to augment the honor of the prophet, and through that, his own honor, by making others aware of his own role in the miracle also. And perhaps this is why, according to Chazal, Gehazi still had Sarat 7 years later, right? As we discussed in the last parak, that Chazal identified Gehazi and his three sons as the four lepers who saved Shomron from the Aramean siege. And this is really in line with Elisha's prophecy that his Sarat would last forever, because Gehazi still hadn't conquered the haughtiness that led to his being afflicted with Sarat in the first place. In Pasuk Vav, in verse 6, we're told that the king responded to the Isha Shunamit's request by appointing an officer to help her restore all that had been taken from her, including all the produce from her fields that she should have received from the day that she left until the current day. In the next section of the Parak, in Psukim Zayin through Tet Vav, in verses 7 through 15, we see yet another Aramean in awe of Elisha and seeking out his prophetic advice, this time the king of Aram himself. And this is actually in stark contrast to Ahaziahu, the Jewish king, the son of Ahav, who back in Parak Aleph in chapter 1 had sent messengers to a foreign country to seek out their pagan god's prophecy about his illness, and he was punished for this. But now we're seeing just the opposite. The non-Jewish king of a foreign country, right, Aram, was doing the same thing in the opposite direction, because he was reaching out to Elisha, who was a Navi from Malchut Yisrael, in order to seek out Hashem's advice. And perhaps this is another indication that Elisha's model of prophecy just worked better than Eliyahu's, because as passionate as Eliyahu was, in the end, his fiery ways didn't really serve to inspire Bnei Yisrael or their kings to follow Hashem. Elisha, on the other hand, with his soft and caring demeanor and his focus on helping others, the kold mama daka, the thin, soft voice that Hashem had tried to get Eliyahu to use, but he wasn't able to. So instead, Hashem said, fine, then appoint a successor who's going to be able to, and that's Elisha. And he, using that kold mama daka, that thin, soft voice, was successful in inspiring even foreigners to reach out to Hashem for help. In verses Zayin through Chet, in Psukim Zayin through Chet, verses 7 through 8, we're told that Ben-Hadad, the king of Aram, fell ill. And he sent his servant messenger named Hazael to Elisha with the following words. He says, Kach biyatzcha mincha, take in your hands a gift, v'lech likrat isha elokim, and go greet the man of God. V'darashta et Hashem me'ito lemor, and inquire of Hashem from him, saying, Ha'echya mecholi hazeh, will I survive this illness? In Pasuk 10, in verse 9, Hazael did exactly as Ben-Hadad requested, and Elisha responded to him in the next Pasuk, in verse 10, Lech emor lo chayo techia, go say to him that he will surely live, v'hirani Hashem ki mut yamut, and Hashem has shown me that he will surely die. And so Elisha seems to be telling Hazael to lie to Ben-Hadad here, and tell him he's going to survive, even though really he's not going to. But how can Elisha tell Hazael to lie? Isn't that dishonest? Doesn't the Torah tell us in Shmot Perach of Gimel, Pasuk Zayin, chapter 23, verse 7, Midbar Sheker Tirchak, right? Distance yourself from falsehood. How can a Navi of Hashem encourage the violation of a mitzvah of such an important value in the Torah? What's going on here? Interestingly, if we look closely at the Pasuk, there's actually a discrepancy between the Kri, the way that we read it, and the Ktiv, the way that it's written, of the word lo. So the Kri of the word lo, meaning the way that it's read out loud, is spelled with a lamed and a vav, which means that it should be read as the word to him, which makes the entire phrase mean say to him, he will surely live, and that's how we already translated it. However, the ktiv of the word lo is spelled with a lamed and an aleph, which means that it should be written as the word no or not. And that changes the entire phrase to mean say that he will surely not live. This might be one way to solve the difficulty, since according to the Ktiv, Elisha was actually telling Hazael to tell Ben-Hadad the truth, right? Say that he will surely not live. There were no lies involved. He's not going to live. However, it's not a perfect solution because, first of all, the Kri is still there. We have to deal with the Kri. But even more so, several psukim later in Pasuk Yudal in verse 14, when Hazael actually did inform Ben-Hadad of what Elisha said, he tells him, Amarli chayu techia. He told me, you shall surely live. So if Hazael did lie to Ben-Hadad in the end, why would the Ktiv in our Pasuk write Elisha's instructions of what to tell Ben-Hadad as being the opposite? Perhaps we can suggest that the Ktiv here serves merely to highlight the problematic nature of the Kri, maybe. Anyway, there are several different person names who address this difficulty, aside from the Kri Uktiv, but the actual difficulty of Elisha's apparent encouragement of Hazael's dishonesty, and they have various approaches. So the Mitzvah David explains that Elisha told Hazael to lie to Ben-Hadad in order to comfort him. But why would lying be okay for comfort? Perhaps because, as we know, Judaism puts extreme value on every minute of life. It is therefore totally usher and forbidden to do anything that may add to the stress of a dying person in any way, lest the added stress cause that person to die any sooner than they would have otherwise. And so therefore, Elisha told Hazael to lie to Ben-Hadad so as not to cause Ben-Hadad undue stress so that he wouldn't unwittingly shorten his life by even a moment. That's Mesudat David's approach. The Malbim points out that Elisha didn't actually tell Hazael to lie, but rather to answer Ben-Hadad's specific question. Ben-Hadad wanted to know if he would die of this illness, right? If we go back to the words of Pasuchet, verse 8, when Hazael, when Ben-Hadad specifically asked Hazael to ask Elisha, he said, Ha'echya mecholize, will I survive this illness? And so, technically, the answer to Ben-Hadad's specific question was no, because Ben-Hadad was not going to die of this illness, but rather because, as we'll learn later in the parak, in Pasuk Tevav, verse 15, Hazael is going to kill him. Finally, the Radak suggests that by telling Hazael that Ben-Hadad will die, and then following that up later in Pasuk Yud Gimel, verse 13, with the prophecy that Hazael himself will become king afterwards, Elisha was intentionally hinting to Hazael that he should assassinate the king without saying it outright. And so based on this Radak, it seems that Elisha was intentionally telling Hazael to be dishonest in order to help him with his forthcoming assassination attempt. Because if Hazael told Ben-Hadad that he would survive, then hopefully Ben-Hadad would let his guard down, and that would allow Hazael to successfully assassinate him. Now, if this Radak is correct, then Elisha is actually instigating Ben-Hadad's assassination. Why would he do that? But we have to remember that back in Malachim Aleph, Perek Yotet, Pasuk Tetvav, in Kings 1, chapter 19, verse 15, when Hashem commanded Eliyahu to anoint Hazael as king over Aram, as one of the three commands that Hashem gave him upon his resignation as Navi. And since Eliyahu never fulfilled that command during his lifetime, it fell upon Elisha to fulfill it in his place. Yet technically, Elisha didn't have the power to anoint a new king of Aram. He wasn't an Aramean citizen. The Arameans were not going to listen to him. And therefore, the only way he could actually fulfill Hashem's command to Eliyahu was by actively crafting a scheme through which Hazael would be able to become king through his own actions. After Elisha told Hazael what to say to Ben-Hadad, Elisha started to cry in Pasuk Yud Aleph, verse 11. And then Hazael questioned him in Pasuk Yud Bet. According to the Barbanel, he was wondering, why would this Navi of Malchut Yisrael be so upset that Ben-Hadad, my king, is going to die? Like, what? Why is that such a big deal? But then Elisha clarified, and he said, Ki adati et asher ta'asel evnei Yisrael ra'a. No, I'm not crying because I'm worried about Ben-Hadad's death, but rather because I know the evil that you will do to Bnei Yisrael. Mivtzareim teshalach ba'esh, you will set their strongholds on fire. Ubachureim bacherev taharog, and their young men you will kill by the sword. Ve'olalehem tiratesh, and their children you will dash into pieces. Vaharoteim tibakeya, and their pregnant women you will rip up. In other words, you will cut open their uterus and take out their fetuses. Horrible, horrific, graphic imagery of cruelty. And Hazael responded in the next pasuk, in Pasuk Yud Gimel, verse 13, asking how on earth he'd be able to even do all these terrible things. He didn't have any power. To which Elisha replied, Hirani Hashem Otzcha Melech al Aram. Hashem has shown me that you will be king of Aram. And so Elisha wasn't crying because of the imminent death of Ben-Hadad, but because of all the terrible things he knew Hazael was going to do to Bnei Yisrael after he became king. Rav Elchanan Samit suggests that Elisha's tears must have had an impact on Hazael, because in addition to recognizing that he owed his entire monarchy to Elisha, it seems that the memory of Elisha's tears ultimately served as a moral restraint on his actions towards Bnei Yisrael. Because even though Hazael ultimately did almost destroy Bnei Yisrael's army, we never end up hearing of his fulfillment of Elisha's prophecy, describing his cruelest potential, which means that he never ended up attacking their women and their children and their young men in the graphic ways that Elisha had described. So there seems to have been a very nice purpose and ultimate benefit to Elisha's tears here. In Psukim Yodal through Vav, in verses 14 through 15, Hazael returned to the palace in Aram, and when Ben-Hadad asked him what Elisha had told him, Hazael responded that Elisha had told him that Ben-Hadad would surely live. But the next day, Hazael soaked a blanket in and covered Ben-Hadad's face with it until he died of suffocation, after which Hazael became king of Aram. In the last section of the parak, the pendulum swings back from Malchut Yisrael to Malchut Yehuda. And this is the first time we're focusing exclusively on Malchut Yehuda since the beginning of Malachim Bet, even though we have learned a lot about this kingdom in Malachim Aleph. This is the first time we're learning about the kingdom in Malachim Bet as a sole focus. Now, in Pasuk Tazayin, in verse 16, we're told that Yehoshaphat's son Yehoram succeeded him to the throne. Yes, there is already a Yehoram as king of Malchut Yisrael right now at this time. And now we're seeing a second, different Yehoram becoming king of Malchut Yehuda. I don't know why. It must have been a popular name at the time. But as a reminder, since it's been a while since the text has discussed Malchut Yehuda, let's just remember who Yehoram's father was. Yehoram's father was Yehoshaphat, who was an extremely righteous king, who was actually introduced to us back in Malachim Aleph Perek Chav Bet in Kings 1, chapter 22, and was described as having followed in the ways of his righteous father Asa and their ancestor David. In fact, in Divrei Hayamim Prakim Yud Zayin through Chav, chapter 17 through 20, we're told that he removed the Avodah Zarah from the kingdom, and specifically that he did not follow in the ways of Malchut Yisrael and did not worship the Baal. And that as a reward, Hashem gave him menucha, or rest, from his enemies. We're also told that Yehoshaphat appointed Levim to teach Torah, Shoftim, judges to judge morally, which might be the reason for his name, which is Yehoshaphat, which means that Hashem judges. Unfortunately, Yehoshaphat's son Yehoram, who succeeded him, did not follow in his ways at all, as we might have expected him to do, because Yehoshaphat followed in his father Asa's ways, and Yehoshaphat was such a tzaddik, we would hope that his own sons would follow in his ways. But in fact, we're told that just the opposite happened in Pasuk Yerchet, verse 18, Vayilech bederach Malchei Yisrael, and he followed in the ways of the kings of Israel, exactly whom Yehoshaphat is described as specifically not following in Divrei Hayamim. Kaasher asu beit Achav, as did the house of Achav, ki bat Achav haitalo leisha, because the daughter of Achav became his wife. Vayas hara b'enei Hashem, and he did evil in the eyes of Hashem. We're told that Yehoshaphat had married off his son to the daughter of Achav, and she became the dominating influence over her husband. Kind of reminds us of how Yezebel was the dominating influence over her husband Achav as well. But it's confusing, because Yehoshaphat was such a righteous king. Why was he willing to marry off his son to Achav's daughter? Achav was the worst king of all time. He actually brought the worship of foreign gods into Malchut Yisrael. Why would Yehoshaphat, a tzaddik, want his son to marry into a family with that kind of terrible spiritual influence? It seems that Yehoshaphat valued achdut, unity, within the nation, especially following a long period of divisiveness between the two kingdoms. So perhaps Yehoshaphat felt that this strong bond of achdut was worthwhile, even with an evil king such as Achav. And maybe he thought that he could potentially positively influence Achav and convince him to worship Hashem correctly. And perhaps he thought his son Yehoram would be able to do the same with his new wife. But unfortunately, as we have just seen in the text, that was not to happen. Yehoshaphat should have considered that there was an equal risk that the daughter of Achav would negatively influence his son Yehoram and his kingdom. But ultimately, he didn't realize this. He didn't consider it. And that led to his own descendants being returned to the world of Avodah Zarah that his own father had made sure to leave. In Pasuk Yetet, in verse 19, we're told that the only reason why Hashem did not destroy Malchut Yehuda at this time was because of his promise to David HaMelech that his dynasty would be eternal, implying that their sins were so egregious that they really deserved destruction, but Hashem held off. Instead, as described in Psukim Chaf through Chaf Bet in verses 20 to 22, Hashem punished Yehoram in a different way. We're told that Edom rebelled against Malchut Yehuda's authority over them and appointed their own king for themselves. And Yehoram went to fight against them in order to reestablish his authority over them, but his people fled, so he ended up losing the battle and thereby Malchut Yehuda's authority over Edom forever. We're also told that Livna revolted at the same time, which must have been an additional punishment. In Psukim Chav Gimel through Chav Hei, verses 23 through 25, we're told of the death of Yehoram and his son Achaziahu's succession to the throne. This is another repeated name that sounds familiar from Malchut Yisrael, but this time there actually is a compelling reason for the repeat. We're told in Pasuk Chavav, in verse 26, that Achaziahu, Melech Yehuda's mother, was Ataliah, the daughter of Omri. And since back in Pasuk Yerchad, in verse 18, we were told that his father Yehoram had married the daughter of Achav, most of the Parshanim assume that this Ataliah was in fact the daughter of Achav, and that she's described as the daughter of Omri in this Pasuk because grandchildren are like children. Now, if Achaziahu's mother, Ataliah, was Achav's daughter, that means that Achav's son Achaziahu, who died after falling from his attic back in Perek Aleph in chapter 1, that Achaziahu was Ataliah's brother. So it actually makes sense, based on Jewish tradition, that she'd name her son after her deceased brother. In Pasuk Chav Zayin, we're told that again, due to Ataliah's evil influence, this time as the king's mother, after she was the king's wife and influenced her husband, now she's the king's mother and influenced her son. And unfortunately, Achaziahu did evil in the eyes of Hashem, following the ways of the house of Achav, just like his father did. In Psukim Chav Chet through Chav Tet, in verses 28 through 29, we're told that Achaziahu joined his uncle Yehoram in war against Hazael, the king of Aram. And Yehoram was wounded during this battle, so he returned back home to Yisrael to heal from his wounds. And Achaziahu went there to visit him since he was sick. This information will become very relevant in the next parak, in Parak Tet, chapter 9, because that's when we'll see that this battle and the subsequent Bikur Cholim visit on the part of Ahazyahu will also have played a significant role in punishing Ahazyahu for, and Yehoram also, for their terrible sins. This year was dedicated by Michelle Levine and Susan Schuster and their families in memory of their beloved mother, grandmother, and great-grandmother, Rebbetzin Gloria Leff, Golda Tzivia Bat Baruch. Rebbetzin Leff was a highly regarded principal and Torah teacher, a master educator, whose deep love for teaching Torah inspired hundreds of students throughout her lifetime.